going back to the narrative of David and Goliath, I would like first of all to deal with a little bit of an apologetic. In other words, an apologetic means here in a passage we have a problem. And the problem that is faced in the account of David and Goliath is this. It's the reconciling of 1 Samuel 16, 19 through 21 with 1 Samuel chapter 17 and verse 58. And that's a problem we need to deal with and we need to try to settle or at least get a feasible answer for. And let's read both, and I think the problem will pop up in front of you immediately. Chapter 16 now, verses 19 through 21. So Saul sent messengers to Jesse and said, "Send me your son David, who is with the flock." So notice Saul knows of David, and he knows that David's father's name is Jesse. So verse 20, Jesse took a donkey loaded with bread and a jug of wine and a young goat and sent them by Saul, to Saul by David his son. And so in every indication there, it would seem that Saul knew David and Saul knew that his father's name was Jesse. Well, as we continue on in the context, we get down to chapter 17 and verse 58. After the slaying of Goliath, we have these words. Saul said to him, that is David, "Whose son are you among a young man?" And David answered, "I am the son of your servant, Jesse the Bethlehemite." The problem pops off the page, does it not? How is it that in chapter 16, in his court, he knows that his father's name is Jesse? And when you come to chapter 17, after the slaying of Goliath, Saul calls him in and says, "Whose son are you, young man?" And so immediate problem enters in. Now there's two ways you can go on that. Number one, the liberal approach would simply say this. It would attempt to investigate no further and it would simply say contradiction. And in most cases, there would be no attempt at reconciliation. It's just one of those things that we have in the Bible. And at this point, it contradicts itself. And by the way, if we don't think handling some of these things are important, if you're a student in class in school and a professor presented this to you, what would you do? What would you say? And when we have students who have not been taught some of these answers, they don't have an answer. And when you don't have an answer, the remark of the liberal seems feasible. Yes, there seems to be an error here, does there not? But let's put in some considerations that certainly fit into the picture. And one of them is going to be a very general consideration. And that is this, that the biblical accounts of many events are recorded in broad terms. Events are in broad terms. It's been so long since I've written a term paper, I don't remember the answer to that. I have 250 in my mind. Is that about a double-spaced page with moderate footnotes? 250 words? Or have I forgotten totally? Is that about it? Okay, we must remember that the creation of the heavens and the earth and everything that God made, including the 7 days, is incorporated in 800 words in the Hebrew text. So that is simply saying that you've covered lots of ground in very, very short wording. And very, very few words. And consequently, you would expect that you're probably going to have a lot of questions about a lot of details because the account is very, very short. That is often true of biblical accounts, and it's a general consideration. Always remember that the whole story is never there. And I don't mean Scripture is dishonest. I simply mean it is not the intent of the Bible always to tell the whole story. It is the intent of the Bible to lift out the events in the story that are pertinent to the point being made. But full accounts are very, very rare. That's true of Hebrew texts. That's true of Semitic texts. They're often that way. So the first thing we come at this with is there's a lot of detail left out. Now, I can think of one bit of detail that is left out. In chapter 16, when David comes into Saul's court, that from that particular time, the arrival was not permanent. The arrival of chapter 16 in the court of Saul was not permanent. We are not meant to believe that once David came into the court of Saul and played his harp for him, that he was there forevermore. We cannot even prove that he was there than more than a week. Now, how do we know that? Well, notice when he comes to meet Goliath, we look down at chapter 17 and verse 15. It becomes obvious that after he was arrived in chapter 16 in the court of Saul, that he didn't stay there permanently, but that he went back to Jerusalem, or back to Bethlehem. Notice verse 15 of chapter 17. David went back and forth from Saul. And that was not Saul in his court then. That was Saul out there in the battlefield. From Saul to tend his father's flock at Bethlehem. So he really returned home. From which he continued to work for his father tending flocks. As a matter of fact, when you come over to chapter 17, one of the brothers accuses him of neglecting the flock down at and I've lost this because I just 28. Is it 28 where he's told to go home? Eliab, his oldest brother, heard when he spoke to the men. Eliab's anger was burned against David, and he said, "Why have you come down? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness?" So from Eliab's standpoint, he was not any ways around Saul or the army, but he was back again keeping sheep. Third, in chapter 16, David was known only to Saul for his artistic ability. Only known for his artistic skill. However, and as a matter of fact, the general for Saul didn't even know David. Look at chapter 17, verse 55. He didn't even know who he was. And he was the general. Which would lead us to believe that David, while he might have played the harp, he was completely unknown in the military context. They didn't know who he was. So chapter 17, verse 58... After David kills the Philistine, verse 57 rather, so when David returned from killing the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul and the Philistines with the Philistine's head in his hand. And Saul said to him, "Whose son are you, young man?" And David answered, "I am the son of your servant Jesse the Bethlehemite." And then you get back to even early verses, verse 55, where Abner, the commander, says, "Whose son is this young man?" So notice within the military context, he was totally unknown. Now, why would all of a sudden David draw attention that he never drew from the commander, he never drew from Saul when he was playing the harp in his court? Why would this get his attention? Well, it was a policy that was carried out. It's found in 1 Samuel 14. Remember, as he was in the court, he was known only for his artistic ability. No one jumped up and down and said, "Oh, David, you'd make a great military man." Not at all. They liked his music. They liked his harp. But the policy was, in verse 52 of chapter 14, the war against the Philistines was severe all the days of Saul. And when Saul saw any mighty man or any valiant man, he attached him to his staff. And when David came into the court of Saul, he was not functioning as a mighty man. He was not functioning as a warrior. He was functioning simply as a court musician. So I think there's nothing there to say that there's anything unusual about this type of thing, especially considering the many, many people that are met. Don't we often meet what we think are ordinary people very casually and never bother, "What was their name?" or "Who were you?" or "What was your father?" And then all of a sudden they came to prominence and say, "I remember him now." And you inquire more about him than you did previously. I think that's at least a feasible answer. Yes, Larry.
There's no indication that Rudy played the harp face-to-face.
No, there isn't.
You're so used to being on a first-name basis with everybody that we don't maybe really understand. You wouldn't dress the same way in Saul's presence.
True. True. And even the fact that, remember, David went to battle with his shepherd's clothing on. And so who would this be? Another shepherd. Yeah.
Well, in verse 39, he was talking, and Saul gave David, said, "David, I go with these, for I have not tested them." Mm-hmm. So he recognized him before the battle, and he gave him some stuff to wear. But David said to him, "I can't use these," so he
at least recognized him. Sure. And again, on a problem like this, do we have to have a airtight, provable answer, or is a feasible answer good enough? I'd submit that in any problem like this, a feasible answer is a good answer, and I think it's a feasible one, but one I wanted to approach before we really got to that. And for you that have young people, I would urge you, please, when someone throws out something in the scripture that seems to be contradictory, please be fair enough to give Christian, I don't know what you call it, Christian scholarship a chance. There have been many, many good men throughout history who have faced these things. Christian scholarship has never hit its head in the sand over these things. All of your good commentators have faced them. They've dealt with them. It's unfortunate, however, that many times we just take the liberal answer because it seems like they're right and we quit there. Don't do that. If you will pursue it, you will find that there are answers on all of these things if you'll pursue them very carefully. Another one, and we'll maybe deal with it later, is how come in chapter 16, Jesse had how many sons? 8. How come in Chronicles he had 7? With names. And again, I think that's answerable, but on the face of it, it seems kind of awesome, doesn't it? 7 sons or 8 sons, which is it? But very often those objections on the face of it are not as big as they appear to be. So always give scholarship a chance to address those things. Yeah.
Well, we really don't have any indication of the time span between.
No. And I think you could throw in the emotional state of Saul. He's in this daily battle with the Philistines, and it was terrible. In emotional conditions, sometimes we don't remember too well. I think there are many feasible answers to that. But when you see those or hear them at school, and since we're close together, give me a chance. Let me point you to some of the good work that's been done. Don't just offhand swallow that the critic's criticism is valid and that his answer is correct because it is not. Okay, now let's go to David and Goliath. Okay, remember coming down here now, we're going to be going down two roads. David is one of those few lives that you cannot study by itself. You cannot study David without studying Saul. And therefore, the minute you come to his life, you must keep in front of you David and Saul. And the key word is we're going to see in these passages, David, his development. How he grows to be the great king that he was. And Saul, we're going to see nothing but his deterioration, all the way to suicide. So, two men, side by side, in the same context, in the same age, in the same day, one all the way deteriorates to killing himself, the other man ends up on the throne. And therefore, two roads. The second important thing is the contrast through all of this narrative of God's way of looking at things, divine viewpoint, and man's way of looking at things, human viewpoint. And we've already seen one when man or when human viewpoint looked at David, they looked at David and saw a shepherd. That's all human viewpoint could see. Human viewpoint saw a shepherd. Divine viewpoint, on the other hand, saw a king. We could also compare that in terms of what's the ratio in terms of quantity. Almost everybody saw the shepherd. Only God saw a king. And so an important lesson in the contrast of divine viewpoint and human viewpoint. We also have an illustration of the two kinds of problems. One, the crisis kind. Two, the day-by-day kind. The crisis kind, the day-by-day kind. The crisis kind was Goliath. The day-by-day kind was Saul. David had to flee from Saul, be persecuted by Saul, be pursued by Saul, day in and day out. On the other hand, Goliath was a crisis type. In my opinion, and it's only opinion, number one is much easier than number two. Is it easier to hit a crisis and come through it all right? Or is it harder to be day after day after day after day after day after day? And David proved himself to be successful in both areas. David's success, I would carve that out of chapter 17. And that's 17, 12, 14, 28. 17, 12, 17, 14, 7, 28. And while it's in very general terms, in those three verses, we have the observation that God was with David. And it's what made him the man that he was. All of this comes now into the setting, and I'm outlining this in terms of the paragraph divisions in our Bibles. And in mine, we have 17, 1 through 11 is the first paragraph. 17, 1 through 11. And we started this, but let me say a little more about it. We open up with the participants in this battle between Israel and Philistia, 17, 1 and through 3. And we have the Philistines. Verse 1, the chapter opens. Now the Philistines, and we put beside the word Philistines, equals Palestine. Palestinians, because the word Philistine is the root of the word Palestine. Palestine simply means the place where the Philistines dwelled. They had, number one, 1,000 years of occupancy on the seacoast of Israel. They were very aggressive. They were not pleased at all to maintain their position. They always wanted to expand it. And they were very aggressive. That is one of the things that, in other words, if you would say Philistine, anyone that would say Philistine, they would say that means war, doesn't it? That's right. Philistines, in terms of policy, does mean aggression, a strong aggression. They were left for good reason. That little pocket down to the southeast was always there, and they were always giving Israel's fits. And remember, that was for good reason, and that good reason is found in the book of Judges 3:1-3. Judges 3:1-3. Now these are the nations which the Lord left to test Israel by them. So the first reason for the existence of the Philistines was a matter of testing for Israel, and that is simply this. Will the new generation trust God? Will the new generation that comes on the scene trust God? Always remember, the faith of our fathers will never do. The faith of Christian parents will never do. And if you do any observing at all, you notice that one of the great failings of Christianity is second generation Christianity, whereby you have a very great father, and it's followed by a son that is worthless. And matter of fact, unfortunately, that's almost proverbial, that the son is rarely what the father was. I could give the name, and if I gave the name, you would all recognize it. Had two sons, and when the father, who had a widely known ministry, widely known television ministry, early in television ministries, both of his sons urinated on his grave. And you wonder, with the great orthodoxy of the father and his apparent love for the Lord, what happened? We don't do well with second generation Christianity. And that's because, I think this verse indicates, every generation has to meet its own test. Your mom and dad may be wonderful. That won't do a thing for you. Because it's a new generation, you must pass the test. And notice that's the way we have in chapter 3, reading it again. These are the nations which the Lord left to test Israel by them. That is, all who had not experienced any of the wars of Canaan. And in order that the generations of sons of Israel might be taught war, those who had not experienced it formally. And so the idea is warfare, the Christian battle, must be learned generation after generation after generation. Yes?
I think the key is that we need to internalize the principle of warfare. That's what second generation. Because the parents, lots of times, they give them these principles, but the second generation doesn't internalize.
Have a chance to internalize them. That's a very good point, because, again, just passing on values, as important as it is, you've still got to face it. And so you have to say, I go back to the same thing, don't I? How many Friday nights in seminary we had to decide, will it be a book that I need? A tire for the car or supper. Boy, did that ever internalize. Lots of things that you would never face otherwise, and that has to happen with every generation. That's a very, very good point, and I think what he's driving at right here. Then he tells what the nations are in the following context. A little bit more about these Philistines. How can a pen do that? No. It's my pocket. It's like, where are your glasses? Yeah, on your forehead. Now, a couple of other things we should add down these arrow points about the Philistines. And a third one is this. A chief god, Dagon, D-A-G-O-N. Chief god, Dagon. And I'll put parentheses, located at Gath. Gath is where Goliath was from. Probably involved with this one. They also added Astarte, Queen of Heaven. And they added Baal, the King of Heaven. And they were all familiar to the Canaanites. We are told in Chronicles that in the time of Saul, they had 30,000 chariots prepared for war. Very often our own image of some of these things is pretty deficient. We think of a chariot perhaps in terms of a man riding in the chariot, and unless the chariot runs over you, you're okay. But there were more things to chariots than sort of like an airplane. Difference between an airplane with 50 caliber mounts on it and then a Piper or than a Cessna 172 made a great deal of difference. And they had things mounted on their chariots that were effective in battle. How about this? Protruding out for as much as 18 inches from the wheels would be metal sword-like sharpened pieces. That would move through a crowd, wouldn't it? And consequently, all those things were involved. And this was a horrible prospect because these were chariots as instruments of war, meaning they were armed and they were prepared to crush and kill. One other thing we need to add is that in connection with the Philistines were the Anakim. And the Anakim were a sort of a giant race known for their prowess in battle. Look for Numbers 13. Numbers 13. Numbers 13:27-28. One of the first things that was observed when they were ready to go into the land of Canaan was the giants that were there. So 13:27, the spies are reporting back, told them what the land is like, and thus they told them and said, "We went into the land where you sent us, and it certainly does flow with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. Nevertheless, the people who live in the land are strong, the cities are fortified and very large, and moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there." And if we would trace that elsewhere, we would find that the Anakim were a very powerful warring group of very powerful and famous soldiers that were there. All right, with that now, then back to 1 Samuel 17. Does it surprise you then, with all of that, that the mental attitude that was through all Israel is found in chapter 17 down at verse 11. When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. The panic that set in. Now the essence of chapter 17 is going to be the man who rejected herd mentality. So that we have then coming into the chapter the herd mentality, and by that I mean the masses believed the herd mentality was simply immobilizing fear. Immobilizing fear. And the reason we call it immobilizing fear is simply because when Goliath makes the challenge for 40 days. He has no takers. No one is willing to say, we'll take on this guy. We've heard him for over a month. We're sick of it. We're tired of it. We reject the mentality of fear until we come in to one man who takes divine viewpoint, and he is David, not in his robly, not in his robes of kingship, but in his shepherdly garb. David faces him as shepherd. Now, one other thing we need, and that is looking at the participants. A verse that I just really struggle with at first. And that is, after the participants, we've got a statement about the place. And at first, the verse seemed to me to be so, I think the word is anemic. It just didn't seem to say much. Read verse 3 of chapter 17 and see what it does for you. And the Philistines stood on the mountain on one side, while Israel stood on the mountain on the other side, with the valley in between them. And you will say, that one's a throwaway. I mean, what in the world is involved in this? Why do we even need it? I mean, it's as neutral as you can get, isn't it? Israel was on this mountain, Philistines were on this mountain, and there was a valley in between. But think about that for just a moment. Isn't God saying this? We started out with a level playing field. You can't see at verse 3 where either side has any advantage, can you? Well, why do you think we want to put in a verse that would show neither side has an advantage? Why does he start by saying the field is flat? There is no more belonging to the Philistines than belongs to Israel, and there's a valley in between them. Why would he want to introduce that kind of neutrality, even playing field, into the picture? Well, I take it there's a very, very good reason for it. And that is, we start out with a level field, and God is now going to show that the difference was not in the army, it was not on the mountain, it was not in the valley. The difference was in the mind. And the mindset was different. So from here on, we're going to have that entering the picture. Now, with the next statement in verse 4, we come to the protagonist. And the protagonist is Goliath. As we said, he's only called Goliath about twice. He's called the Philistine 27 times in this chapter. So that really is his primary position. And notice what he says in verse 8. He stands and he shouts at the ranks of Israel and said to them, "Why do you come out to draw up in battle array? Am I not the Philistine and you servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me." And let me introduce a custom that we found in many ANET documents. ANET documents are simply an expression that is used by historians to lump together a lot of ancient literature. And the ANET documents are ancient Near Eastern texts. Ancient Near Eastern texts. And in them, you have lots of kinds of warfare described. So ANET has different kinds of warfare described. And one of them, of those kinds, was this. Each side choose one. Each side choose one. That results in one battle between two, which in terms, in turn saves lives. And in this type of battle, it was a winner-take-all. We could go many places. In the Iliad, the battle is between Hector and Achilles. Hector alone, Achilles alone, fight the battle, and the winner takes all. This was not unusual at all in warfare. And we need to know that because we don't know anything about this. We have never fought a war or in our history known of a war where only the two generals met in battle and the winner was there. Well, this is the setting for this particular thing. Now, the protagonist is described several ways. First of all, his physique. And we'll not give all the details, but if you come to chapter 17, verse 4, it says, Goliath, his height was 6 cubits and a span. Assuming the typical 18-inch cubit, you're looking at a 9-foot-6-inch giant. Notice there's a great and detailed description of his armor. Armor basically in these times had to meet 3 criteria. Number 1, adequate protection. 2, lightness. And 3, flexibility. You didn't want a piece of armor that cut your sword swing in half. It needed to be movable and flexible. And you certainly didn't want to carry something that was too heavy, and it certainly needed to provide protection. Well, notice coming down to verse 4, his height was 6 cubits and a span. He had a bronze helmet on his head. He was clothed with scale armor, which weighed 5,000 shekels of bronze. Typically, the biblical ounce in the Old Testament is 0.403, and that would equal on this man about 126 pounds of armor. Now, keeping in mind, he's 9'6", so I guess 126 pounds of armor wouldn't be excessively. Now, you say, why these details? Why these details? Goliath didn't have a spiritual thing going for him. Everything this man had was material. He had nothing at all besides the material, and I take it. That's why we have this this description here. In the there's a thing called the Qumran war scroll, and it was found among the Qumran tablets, and it was a scroll that does nothing but describe the means and methods of warfare. And they really had some developed stuff. The shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam. When you look down the end of a rifle or a weapon, and you will often want to see if, maybe if it's dirty, what do? You stick your fingernail down at the bottom so you get a reflection. And as you look up the barrel, what do you see? You ladies have not looked down the end of a gun recently? Rifling. What's rifling? Spiral. What's that for? Well, that's when the bullet fires, it will come out spinning like that. And with ancient warfare in the scrolls of Qumran, they talk about how they developed the spear that was wrapped with rope to give it a rifling effect. So not only did the spear just lop up in the air, the spear was going forward like that so that it would stab you and drill you at the same time. So it was very sophisticated the way they did, and that's part of the emphasis of all of the details given here about this man Goliath. emphasis. This is all he had. Now, I don't mean that there weren't other things in his mentality, because there were. There were four things we know about Goliath. In terms of the way the man thought, Goliath was, one, arrogant. Two, proud. Three, defiant. Four, ignorant. Now, what do I mean by each one of these? Arrogant, proud, defiant, and ignorant. Number one, arrogant, because notice in 4 through 7, all he depended upon was himself and his armor. So his trust was in self and weapons. He was proud. Look over at 17:43. He was so proud that when David defied him, he said, "David, who do you think I am?" And he expresses it metaphorically. 17:43. And the Philistine said to David, and if this isn't pride, I don't know what is, "Am I a dog that you've come to me with sticks?" And so his pride becomes very obvious. Defiant, look at 17:10. Again, the Philistine said, "I defy the ranks of Israel." And why was he ignorant? Look at 17:43, last half of the verse. He's ignorant with supreme ignorance because he does not know God. Only God's. So the last sentence, the Philistine cursed David by his gods. So he is ignorant, and that he had no knowledge of the true God. No knowledge of the true God. That's what he's got going for him, and that's all he has going for him. Now, there's an interesting thing that is here, and I pick it up because many years ago, some of the military commanders of Israel picked it up by reading the Bible. And let's see that by comparing it to 17:9. And here's what some of your military leaders in Israel picked up. Never trust the word of your enemy. Never believe your enemy. Now see if you can catch where they caught that. 17:9. Goliath says, if he is able to fight with me and kill me, we will become your servants. That's the word of the enemy. That's a promise. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall become our servants and serve us. They promise to capitulate. Go over to 17:52. What happened? Verse 51, David ran and stood over the Philistine and took his sword, drew it out of its sheath and killed him, cut his head off with it. When the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they fled. And the men of Israel and Judah arose and shouted and pursued the Philistines as far as the valley, to the gates of Ekron, and the slain Philistines lay along the way to Sha'arim, even to Gath and to Ekron. And the sons of Israel returned from chasing the Philistines and plundering their camps. And what we have in here and parallel accounts is that instead of, with the death of Goliath, they saying, okay, we'll keep our promise, we'll keep our covenant. They fought Israel after that all the way to death. And therefore many in Israel said, I don't think we should trust the promises of our enemies. We had the figures one night of, in a 2-year period of history of the world, wasn't it something like 8,000 treaties were made and almost all of them were broken within 2 years. And that's the principle derived from this, is win the victory, bring back heads, and don't trust treaties with the defeated enemy. And that's why Israel's had some of our hard-nosed military policy, because they believe just that. Okay, now let's look at the panic. It's very obvious, verse 11, but we need to see one other thing about it, 17:11. And when Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistines, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. Please note, Saul, singular, heard the words, and Israel, plural, heard the words, and they, all Israel, were dismayed and greatly afraid. In the Hebrew, the pronouns stick out so plainly that there is a chain reaction. Saul heard, and when Saul heard, he was dismayed and afraid. And what is fear in a leader do? It communicates. Saul was afraid, and when Saul was afraid, all of Israel was afraid with him. And so you have a very important principle that's involved there, which is the fear of the king was picked up by the people, or the mental attitude of a leadership is infectious and carries on. Now, we're ready just to introduce our next major section here, but let's caption it first. This was the setting, and now David prepares. And I'm going to underscore the word prepares, because it's going to be quite a while before he meets Goliath. There's a lot of water to go under the bridge. So David prepares to meet Goliath. And notice that the preparation begins in 17 and verse 12. And he doesn't meet him till verse 40. So one thing, just by way of observation, is important. And let's look at verse 12 of 17. And then notice verse 40, the last five words. Verse 12. Now David, and he enters the scene, and you go through all of these verses, and you come down to the last five words of verse 40, and what are they? And he approached the Philistine. So the first question we would ask is, why is this large body of information between here comes David and he meets Goliath, why all of this in between? Well, I think the first thing it obviously says this, there are things we need to know about David before he meets Goliath. And those things come in the following context. In other words, he has heard the defiance of Goliath. He's ready to fight him. But notice in verse 12 on through, we have several things that he has to go through. In the first place, he's sent to the battle scene. He has to encounter his brothers. He has to encounter Israel. And then he has to pass two more tests. Because when he meets his brothers, he gets attacked. Notice 17:28. He gets tackled at least twice before he gets to Goliath. And the things that he gets tackled on are, number one, verses 28 through 30. He faces Eliab. And what kind of battle does he have to face? David, your motives are wrong. And so David fights and wins the battle of criticism of his motives. As soon as that is cleared away, he then faces a second attack. And this is an attack on his ability. Then Saul said to David, "You are not able." So his brother said, "You're not rightly motivated." Saul says, "You're not able." I don't understand this. Why does David have to overcome all this little picky stuff before he can zap Goliath? Because everybody has to come through the picky stuff until you slay a Goliath. And so this is why I take it that we've got lots of detail in here and lots of unpleasant things on the part of David. But he had to pass them. He had to go through them before he ever was ready to face the Goliath. And usually, for the person that handles the details of life, the Goliaths are usually duck soup. They're easy. Because all those little things along the way, your brother that is on your case, the king and your friends that don't believe you can do it, and so forth. He passed all of those things, and I think it is the Holy Spirit giving a very important lesson. You got to pass the little test before you get to the big one. Father, we're thankful for your word and its truth. We pray that we will learn the important lessons that are here. And as on our next study, we begin to see David facing the details that stand in the way, the people that stand in the way, the misunderstanding, the misevaluation of him. May we understand that he had to pass these things before he ever landed his Goliath. For we ask this in Christ's name.